mention of it. There will be increased competition with both Russia and Japan for North Pacific fisheries, particularly, and perhaps for timber and other resources too. That too poses a threat that has not yet been addressed. Another serious threat that I'm sure many of you feel on a daily basis is what's going on in the villages, what's going on in the mental and physical health of the next generation to maintain a subsistence way of life. What are the effects of alcohol on that group? What are the effects of drugs? How are those people living? And are their bodies and minds going to be whole enough to carry on a way of life that you can be proud of in the next generation? How about the values and beliefs of that next generation? What's happening to them as more and more of them are trained outside the villages, as more and more are trying to qualify for positions and salaries? What will happen to them when they are trained as the kinds of scientists whose testimony we have heard is rarely trusted within the village way of life? Do you want them to go to universities? Do you want them to grow up with television? Do you want them to grow up with the social values that are being advocated and imposed by both universities and television and the other media forces that are at work upon them? And one other thing is what's going to happen to the cash as the cash economies of the villages change. We heard the wonderful testimony from Jonathan Solomon that the people in his area have an average income of $700 a year and yet throw $50,000 potlatches. Consider what would happen if the average income in his area were $50,000 per person and they threw $700 potlatches. I think that would have been a significant cultural loss if that point were ever reached. Well, what I'm trying to say is that the world, as well as you, need what you have here. And I admire the energy I see for defending that. I encourage you, and I want to help you to enhance it, and I would beg you to help us learn. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Joe. I think that it might be useful to adjourn in a moment for lunch and then to return and have a roundtable discussion, drawing back, as Joe has urged us to do, from the case studies themselves. Before we do, I might just, if Dave Porter is here, if he or somebody else might join the round table after lunch and tell us a little bit about the Native Broadcasting Network in Canada, because Joe mentioned television, and I think it's worth remembering that technology can be a servant and not just a master, and it may well be an instrument for broadening and deepening Native culture. And I don't see Dave, but I guess he'll be popping in later. So if that's all right with you people, we'll come back for an hour or two this afternoon and chat about these things. We'll come back at 1:15.
Did you talk to Usher?
Yeah.
He's a friend of mine.
Oh, is it?
And I've been in the bush. I insisted he be invited. Then the guest list got a little bit out of hand, and I realized I'd have to just get it. And I also noticed I'm better to take this
What? Oh, yeah, oh, I see, right.
But I talked to him again, and I said, well, weave what you have to say for this.
Is that all?
Well, he's a good guy.
Okay.
He, don't worry.
Okay. I called Bart.
Hmm?
I called Bart. Bart Garber.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, he's at the door. Well, let's just take our seats then, and well, we've been
could be. I don't know. I'm getting documents. That's what we need to see. Yeah.
We've been joined this afternoon by Pat Wallace, who's
Kay Wallace.
Kay Wallace, forgive me. Forgive me, Kay, who's seated next to Rosita Worrell, and Mike Holloway, who's seated next to Jonathan Solomon. Well, he was here yesterday. He's had one interaction, that's all you get. What we thought we might do this afternoon is this. We looked at the case studies on subsistence, then Joe Meeker kind of gave us an overview from about 35,000 feet, and perhaps we might, keeping in mind what Joe has said, zoom down a bit and look at Alaska again and consider the task before us. What are the necessary and sufficient conditions for the continuance of subsistence in the light of Joe's remarks? And I thought what I'd do, if you don't mind, is just go around the table and just see what last thoughts any of you had that you might want to express. Let me say that I'm very pleased with the way we've structured this thing, and I've learned a great deal, and I hope you have. I don't think that it is the kind of roundtable where we can expect to come up with hard and fast conclusions. I don't think it's the type of gathering where we can expect to pass a resolution that settles the whole question of subsistence in Alaska or anywhere else. But if you have any observations on what Joe Meeker has said or what others have said over the last 3.5 days, I think this would be a good time to get them off your chest. And could I also say that Lily of the ICC office has some of the copies of the book Oil and Amulets about the circumpolar region. It's a very good book, and she has some copies at the table over there. I'm afraid that you have to buy them. That's the only catch. But if you'd like to see Lily about obtaining a copy of the book, she'll have copies available. So where would, where might we begin? Perhaps with Rosita Worrell?
Yes. I would like to ask the Canadian delegation, based on their experiences and their observations of Alaska through Dr. Langdon's paper and then also through the discussions here, what might they see as the major pitfalls that that we here in Alaska have in terms of protecting Native subsistence? Where are areas that they might suggest that we should emphasize, or just some general advice?
Any of you, Victor Matander and Dave Porter are respectfully seated, I think, at the back of the hall. And if they or any of you would like to take a shot at that. It looks like they've given all the advice they're capable of offering. Oh, here comes Victor.
What advice? Well, that's a very tough question. Not being fully familiar with exactly what went on over the last while. But I think I've learned quite a bit from this discussions over the last 3 days. And I think one of the things that I see we should be doing is to work more closely together on common problems and issues that we have across northern Canada and Alaska. I think with respect to, if you look back at the Alaska Native Claim Settlement, there were some serious errors made with respect to people's right to resources, particularly subsistence. And I think through this whole process, it has brought people together to stand together to try and salvage or ensure that the proper protections are put in place to protect our people's right to subsist off the land. I think those kind of things, and we will support your fight in that area. I don't think the fight should stop here. It must go on. Not only, as we had heard earlier this morning, there are other countries, other people throughout this world that also subsist. And I think it has to be told to the powers that be, and also to establish the political will to recognize and protect the rights that we have exercised for the last 40,000 years in this part of the country. And I think those kind of things should start. For instance, in the area of the Porcupine Caribou, we have started moving in that area. And I think the end result is going to be satisfactory to our people, both in Canada and the United States, in achieving the proper protection and recognition to that herd. And I also think, too, that it seems to me over the last few days, for instance, in the trapping area, there's not really that much done in Alaska. And I think based on that, you know, we still have a chance to try and put in place proper regimes and management participation from our own people to ensure that that livelihood is protected in the future, and to ensure that that we have input into what happens in that area. I also think, too, for instance, in salmon, it is necessary that we try and protect what we have left in the salmon. It's a resource that is being depleted, and it is something that we must try and stabilize and enhance And keeping in mind, too, that, again, working together and communicating and having that dialogue between the Native peoples of Alaska and Canada must be encouraged. It shouldn't stop here. It must go on. I'm not sure exactly, unless there's a specific question that should be asked to us. I know, for instance, in our situation, we haven't gone to the extent of convincing government, I guess, in Canada to recognize and protect our subsistence rights. We're getting a very strong impression from our own people and concerns that this is something that we must protect, and what we have in place in Yukon today is not acceptable. And they're saying to us that this has to be looked at again, and we have to put in place the proper agreement that reflects our interests and our aspirations to the renewed resources in Yukon. And I think as a result of this, we will be going back to the Yukon, and starting next Tuesday, we have 10 days of meetings from all of the Yukon communities to talk about this very our claim. And hopefully at the end, we will come together in ensuring that the areas of use to the renewable resources are properly reflected in our position to the Government of Canada. So I think with that, I've certainly learned a lot, and I think it's met a lot of good people here, and I think you have a lot of valuable resource people here, both involved at the central level and at the community level, and I think that's something that there seems to be a lot of fight left amongst the people here, and I would very much encourage that and support the that fight to end to the satisfaction of our own people. So with that in mind, thank you very much.
Thank you, Victor. Bob Gamble and then Peter Usher.
I think it certainly would be presumptuous on my part to indicate what Alaskans might be able to do. I think Alaskans can figure that out for themselves. They can look at some of the experiences we've had in Canada and try and apply some of those principles to their own situation. Certainly I find the Alaskan situation quite complex, and I'm only beginning to understand little bits of it, or as I understand parts, I find it's more complex than I originally thought. But one thing that we might keep in mind is that there's been a lot of emphasis placed on the Native claims settlements and progress in settlements in the Yukon and Northwest Territories. And something that you may have heard from the other Native groups in Canada that have appeared at sessions like this before is that their claims is only one part of another process. You may know that the claims process for the Inuit and Dene was drawn out and held up for many years because they were insisting on including constitutional issues in their claims. They have finally decided to abandon that in the claims forum and deal with land claims as the government defines them. But that is that doesn't mean they've given up the constitutional battle. The Inuit are after a Nunavut government. They're after some kind of political power. And the same in the Western Arctic. The Dene are pursuing their form of government that will guarantee their political authority and power in the future to protect these rights. Because I think if we've learned anything, we've learned that whereas in Canada some of the claim settlements looks as though they're very generous, they're generous because they're not impinging on the rights of others. They're not competing for the same resources. In the northern Yukon, Natives have got exclusive rights to harvest. but nobody else is harvesting there presently, virtually. So it's no threat to anyone else. And I think you see that pattern extended into Alaska. The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission has some success. What other American citizens want to compete directly for the bowhead whale? So where the larger society is not threatened, or where they don't have to give anything else up, then there's some encouraging progress. The real battle is going to be moving into areas where there is competition, where you try to apply those same principles in this part of Alaska, or as we have seen in Yukon, the difficulty they've had applying those principles in the southern portion of the Yukon. The Yukon claim is divided into northern and southern portions. There are different conditions apply there. And so what I'm saying in sum is, in the Northwest Territories, the Native people are after some political authority and political power to blend with their claims and to back up their claims. They're two parts of the same basic issue. I hear some of the same kinds of things in Alaska. They've been mentioned around this table. And outside of this room and in bars and talking to other people, Native people from Alaska who are not necessarily here, I hear a lot of frustration, resentment, and a lot of difficulty in focusing on how to tackle the problems that they see with their corporations, with their subsistence, and so forth. And a lot of these people are saying similar things. They're saying our solution is sovereignty, right? In effect, that's a political solution as well. So I think it's useful to keep in mind that you know, the political solution in the long run is what people in Canada are after as well.
Peter Usher.
Well, I guess if there were a glass on the table and there were liquid in it that went about halfway up, some people would say the glass is half empty, some people would say it's half full. And I guess in a way that's my response to what I've seen going on in Alaska. From my knowledge of it from some years back and from what I've learned today, I would have been quite pessimistic 10 years ago with the future of the subsistence economy. And I'm perhaps not too surprised, but certainly delighted to hear all the things that you have managed to do to defend your interests, and I would say advance them, in the last 10 years, so that in many respects the picture looks, as an outsider, much brighter to me than I would have said some time ago. But I think that there are three areas which we have hardly touched on in the last little while that I would just throw out for your consideration as possible, that present some dangers to the future of subsistence and at the same time present some opportunities for people to think about and do something about. One of which I will touch only very briefly on is the question of the property interest in renewable resources. That it seems to me that Aboriginal rights constitute a property interest in fish and wildlife resources, and that with full regard to the limitations of what property can do for you, I would cite one example which you may have heard about from Canada. I worked some years ago for two bands in northwestern Ontario that were affected by mercury pollution. And as a consequence, those two reserves, which had depended entirely on the commercial fishery, the sport fishery for employment, and the domestic fishery for most of their food, were cut off from all of those things. And still to this day, 14 years later, and despite violent demonstrations, despite the most horrendous rates of suicides, alcoholism, drug abuse, child neglect, all of which things I think can be directly related to the loss of the fishery, and to enormous publicity and favorable publicity received to this day, really no compensation to the fishermen. I should qualify that with the fact that there has been a negotiated arrangement in a general way with those bands. But I think really to the fishermen and their families, no compensation whatever. And I think to tell those people that it would have been no value to them to have had a property interest which was defensible and compensable with respect to third parties, I don't think they would agree with you that that would have been of no value to them.
You mean a property interest in the fishery?
Yes.
Looking on the fishery as their property, and if it's destroyed, they can sue somebody and get some money.
That's right, that you can get either an injunction against damage or compensation for damage which has occurred. I have no idea about how you would go about that in Alaska. I assume from all the other things you've done that you could probably perhaps do something about that too. I would like to turn a bit to the economic questions very briefly. I'm reminded of something that you, sir, told us in Inuvik almost 10 years ago in our deliberations, which was that there's no such thing as a free lunch. And I think that applies to the subsistence economy as much as any other. And I'd like to just throw out a few areas where I think that does pose some limits. We've already discussed at various times the costs of pursuing the traditional economy, of the very great costs. And somebody commented yesterday it cost $700 to go out and hunt caribou, and that if you can only get five during that course, it's not a very economical way to go about things. Well, what we're in is a situation where the ability to harvest is more and more dependent on access to not the resources themselves, but to cash. And that, it seems to me, is the real problem that's going to face a lot of subsistence economies. And the few observations I'll make on this are based not only on the experience of hunters and trappers in the Canadian North, but also looking at the experience of subsistence farmers and fishermen further south, because I think what's happened to them may be some indication of the dangers, not necessarily that will happen, but could happen, to people in this situation, even though what they're harvesting is wild resources. The two critical issues, it seems to me, are one, the question of how much you invest in productive capacity compared to what you get out of it, and second of all, what is the time allocation between wage labor or business or any other activity that you're engaged in and subsistence activity. Now, one of the consequences, it seems to me, of tying harvesting investment to some other source than the income from subsistence activity, like trapping or whatever, is that the rate of that investment is divorced from the productivity of the investment. We know that in the Canadian North that harvest levels are remaining approximately the same. This is in a broad level, say for the Northwest Territories, we're looking at something like 2.5 million kilograms of food production. That's a level that could in fact be increased, although certainly not more than twofold is the general estimate of that. At the same time, we know that people are continuing to be able to engage in that by virtue of more and more wage employment, more and more money coming from somewhere else in order to get that food. We also know that they're spending a heck of a lot more to get it than they used to. And the figures are really astronomical. If we look back 20 years when maybe your annual cost of outfitting was $500 to $1,000, we know that we're talking about $500 just to go on one trip now. So there's a huge difference. The problem is, if you're not producing more, there's got to be some point when the investment is no longer worth it. And if the only way you can get it is, in fact, to invest those vast amounts in order to get returns that are not increasing, then I think that's where the problem comes in. Now, we know that people are affording more and better equipment, and that has solved one of the problems of recent years, which has been urbanization, because when urbanization first occurred, people couldn't get out as much as they used to, and they would hunt close to the community and not so much far away. We know that things like snowmobiles and airplanes and so on have solved that problem. People can cover just as much area as they used to, but it costs a lot of money. At the same time, that expenditure on resources is a response to wage employment. If you have to be in wage employment more and more, then you must substitute capital for labor. Dan mentioned earlier that these things take time. And if you have less and less time and must use capital in order to spend that time economically, you start thinking about time very differently. I would suggest that you're no longer in a position to make the kinds of observations that Harvey talked about what's going on in the environment around you. I think there are also risks in losing your productive capability. Now, we haven't got to that stage in the North where people are having to go to the bank and really go into hock to buy the pickup trucks, the ATVs, the snowmobiles, the big outboards, and so on. Not very often. But the experience in the South is lots of farmers are losing their farms today. Lots of fishermen are losing their fishing boats. And with it, they've lost their access to the traditional resource. And that's a process that certainly concerns me. Well, I think that really, in a sense, the time allocation thing is something that I guess we're all familiar with, any of us who do this kind of activity, of any kind of subsistence activity, that it just becomes more and more of a problem as to when you can get the time to do this effectively. And there's another aspect to that problem of time. It's not only the problem of actually getting the time to go out hunting, but more and more in any small community, a rural community or northern community, we find that there's a kind of the time of the whole community becomes oriented to the job, to the school, regular meal times, regular occurrences of this, that, and the other, which is really quite a different system of time than subsistence activity operates on normally. By and large, country food is not convenience food, and I think people resort to convenience food in the grocery stores, not because they don't like country food anymore or don't want it, but because it's convenient. It's the only way they can live and manage to send their kids to school and make sure somebody gets off to the job and you know, run the household. I mean, these are the daily affairs we all have to deal with, and we see that kind of thing happening in the North. And after all, the business of putting food on the table involves just as much women's labor as it does men's. And if we're looking at women more and more going into the labor force, which I think is typical of most northern communities, that's a problem too. Well. So I think there are limits on how much income from either wage labor or business or anything else can be put into the subsistence economy. Now, we hear more and more about the possibility of turning the subsistence economy into a business or an industry, by which we mean somehow selling these resources for cash or converting them into cash and so on and so forth, and I don't want to suggest that some of those things aren't very good ideas, but they also carry certain dangers as well. Because it's more possible now to turn what you eat into cash rather than byproducts like fur or ivory or whatever. And when people can start turning what they eat into cash, we know very well what happens in third world agriculture and so on, is that they don't produce the stuff for themselves anymore. They produce stuff for export. And the quality of what they eat declines very, very significantly. It's not the same world anymore in that regard. And we're looking at no longer simply a case of individuals or villages deciding what they're going to do with their resources, but corporations, regardless of who runs them. The decisions that a corporation will make in that regard may well be very different than what individuals or tribes or villages would make. Well, if there's limits on how much money you can pump into a subsistence economy or get out of it, there's one other strategy for getting along, and that's becoming more self-sufficient, or substituting what you import with what you can produce for yourself. And one of the things that I think both native and non-native people who rely on a subsistence life know in their bones is that when time gets tough, it's subsistence that you rely on. Now, that's the problem, it seems to me. When I look at the northern economy, and for that matter, the southern economy, I don't wonder if the bubble will burst, I wonder when it will burst. And because subsistence depends not only on the resources still being there, all this question of managing the lands and managing the resources, It also depends on the access to resources being there and to everyone still having the knowledge and the tools to use them. So all those three things are necessary conditions to subsistence continuing on. And it seems to me that universal access to subsistence resources, which is the basic principle of subsistence life, that principle is what is the most threatened by industrial and commercial arrangements, whatever other benefits they bring, and I don't deny that they're substantial. Now, I'd like to finish with one comment, one other threat to subsistence that we certainly see in the Canadian North, and I've only heard a little bit about it here, but I guess the whaling thing is a good example of it, and that is, unfortunately, in the industrial world, there is a growing sentiment that it is wrong to kill and use wild animals. The consequences of that with respect to seal hunting in the eastern Arctic has been drastic indeed. I'm sure you're well aware of it. That has happened despite government support for the seal fishery. And not only the seal fishery in the north, but the seal fishery in Newfoundland. The Canadian government got very badly defeated on that issue, despite its best efforts. And I think there's a serious lesson to be learned here, that's going to be a big issue, and one which, as small communities or small groups, will be very difficult to take on, other than the kinds of strategies that you're already developing, which is to deal internationally and so on. But a comment I'd like to make about that is this. Don Mitchell rightly pointed out the other day that most people do not get to use their property exactly as they please, unless you're quite powerful and rich, and most of us aren't. For you to use and enjoy a property or any other right in the North today, you will have to demonstrate to others that you continue to have a moral claim upon that right. Because the North today is like a fishbowl. Everybody's looking in, just like the rest of the world. And the reason that things like boycotts and embargoes work is because the targets of those things are dependent on other people, on world trade, and so on. Small communities, like large ones, enjoy the comfortable life at a price. And I'm reminded again that there's no such thing as a free lunch. So what I'm wondering about, because I didn't hear too much about it in the presentations that were made, is having asserted control and sovereignty over your resources, how do you demonstrate that you have the necessary authority and power that go with that sovereignty? And what I mean by that are, how do you enforce the rules? And how effective are those means of enforcement? And I'll give you two examples of that. One is the individual hunter who violates the normal rules of your community. And the other is the individual corporation, which in some ways by its proposals and actions may violate other rules. So what is your control, and how effectively can you exercise that control over the ones who violate the rules? We've had some problems with that in Canada, and occasional reports in the newspapers about greatly excessive kills of caribou or narwhals or whatever. And whatever the truth of those things, and however much the outsiders may be ignorant or foolish or uninformed, the fact is that they are left with impressions. They go away with those impressions, and they stick long after the explanations in the reports and so on and so forth. So, knowing that image is a serious matter nowadays, I ask that question about how you exercise that control internally, not simply for my own curiosity, but because many outsiders who are much less sympathetic than I are going to be asking those questions of you all the time, and you will have to satisfy them as well as yourselves that you maintain your credibility and your legitimacy in this northern fishbowl. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come here. I've enjoyed it very greatly.
Thank you, Peter, for raising those issues. Worth thinking about. I forgotten who had been trying to, Hugh Monahan, if you can get the microphone back. You might also tell us, if you feel free to do so, at the meeting of the International Porcupine Caribou Commission the other night, you mentioned something that Peter touched on, that is the mistakes that biologists had made in estimating the size of the Beverly Caminuria caribou herd, which is the largest herd, I think, in North America. And I remember, if I may be forgiven for mentioning this, making a speech once about 3 years ago in eastern Canada, and some biologists teaching the nearby university. I was speaking in defense of native rights in northern Canada, and some biologists cornered me and said, you know, the natives had been overhunting the Beverly Caminuria herd, and 80,000 animals had been destroyed, or the population was down by some god-awful number, and I just retreated into the night, not knowing exactly what to say to these infuriated scientists. And you were good enough to mention that the other night. If it's not classified, could you just...
Perhaps I can comment on that in a minute, and that'll give me, as I talk, a chance to think about how I might phrase that cautiously. But first of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting our participation here. I've enjoyed it very much. Unfortunately, as I predicted, I was able to learn an awful lot more than I was able to contribute. I do wish my minister, Nellie Cornway, had been able to make it here, because I think she could have contributed in quite a different fashion than I'm able to, having her long experience in native rights issues and now being one of the senior people in our political system. However, as I say, despite that, I've certainly benefited from this. Being a Canadian administrator in the natural resource field, I'm loath to provide specific advice, Marie, on how you might improve your situation in the American scene. And as a matter of fact, I'm unable to do that on the broader front that Peter Usher and some of the others have spoken to here. However, there is two specific comments that I would like to make, and one will feed into your question, Judge Berger. It seems to me that the question of subsistence and maintenance of that lifestyle and the culture are really the key elements that we've been focusing on here, and they're obviously the key elements that I've been confronted with in land claim negotiations now for some 10 or 12 years. It's obviously a crucial issue. It's going to continue to be that way. Within that frame, it seems to me that there's two basic requirements for the maintenance of this lifestyle and culture. The first is, despite what Dr. Haltus has indicated, I feel that obviously you've got to be able to maintain the renewable resource base that people rely on for that lifestyle, in particular a reasonable level of environmental quality. If that's a basic truth, and I believe it to be, then I would encourage the native people to be as active as possible in the management of those resources and in environmental protection. It seems to me that we've heard a couple of good examples here in the last couple of days, the Whaling Commission, the Porcupine Caribou Commission. The attempts that you people are making to become actively involved in the maintenance of those resources, I think, is very positive. We have some recent experience in this in Canada, and it would suggest that governments and the native people can work positively on issues like this. I would encourage you to become proactive, and by that I mean not waiting as we did in the case of the Beverly and Caminuria caribou herd until we had what we thought was a crisis at that time, because emotions are charged and it's difficult to work together and you have to overcome a lot of hurdles. But I would encourage you to become more proactive and become directly involved with these agencies at an early stage before there is a panic. Judge Berger, to answer your question about the specifics of those two herds, we had, for the background of those that aren't familiar with it, an apparent decline in both herds. The Caminuria herd that had been predicted based on 25 years' data that it was going to be eliminated as an economic resource in a period of 8 years. The Beverly herd, which was considerably larger, in excess of 100,000 originally, was thought to possibly run into obscurity in as soon as 5 years if we were carrying on at the current rate. This was based on the wisdom at the time, using the best techniques that were available to biologists. They were forthright. And I think I have to say perhaps a little dogmatic. For various reasons, it became a hot public issue. And as I mentioned, emotions became very charged. But the end result, after much work, was government and the Native associations formed a management board to work jointly on the problem. Interestingly enough, it turned out in the middle of this process of forming the board that we conducted a survey that showed an anomaly. We had a lot more animals than we thought we had. There was a marked silence amongst some of those that had felt so strongly earlier about the state of the herd. Some claimed the trend was the same, it was just that we had more animals and that the trend was still going down. Since then, that anomaly has not become an anomaly, it's become a consistent number that's considerably higher than the reduced levels of caribou that we thought we had. So the situation is obviously less pressing than it was. But I guess to try and look at the half-full glass, as Peter would call it, or as he referred to earlier, it at least forced us to acknowledge that we in the science of wildlife management have to acknowledge that it's often an art, we're on a learning curve, and we were obliged to get back to our roots and work with the people that were relying on that resource. And I think it's turning out to be a positive example. The resource users now feel that they're fully involved in the process of developing management plans. And I think, although it's been a very good lesson for us on both sides as managers and users, you people also are having some similar experiences here. And I guess my message is let's continue in both countries to work together both as resource users and resource managers.